we had the ability, and I think the duty, to tell the Attorney General what our recommendation was with respect to the facts. And if you put the legal issue aside, which is whether the president is covered by the obstruction statute, I think most career federal prosecutors worth their salt would say that the proof was sufficient to find obstruction.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 9th, 2020. Andrew Weissman was the general counsel of the FBI. He was the head of the Justice Department's fraud section. He helped run the Enron task force, and yet he is best known these days for having been one of Bob Mueller's top prosecutors, and certainly the most smeared of Bob Mueller's prosecutors. Weissman's name became a kind of tagline for Mueller's supposedly evil alter ego as the investigation went on. And Andrew now has a book about the whole experience, what the Mueller investigation did right, what it did wrong, what it could have done differently, and how it all went down from the inside. He joins me here in front of a live podcast audience. We have 75 people watching this event live. They will be able to ask questions. So if you hear voices that you don't recognize in the Lawfare podcast, that's because there is actually a live audience here. They would be rapturously applauding right now, except that we can't hear them. They can only hear us. It's the Lawfare podcast, October 9th. Andrew Weissman on Where Law Ends. Andrew, you know, we knew each other back in the before days, before there was a Mueller investigation. Then we were very self-consciously out of touch for several years. It's good to know you again.
It's good to be here. Yes, I'm thinking back to the halcyon days when all we had to worry about was the Supreme Court Jones decision and the Boston Marathon bombing case and the Snowden leaks. Those very calm days pre-special counsel investigation.
So this book has gotten a fair bit of attention because in certain discrete areas, you are critical of key decisions that Bob Mueller made. I want to talk about some different aspects of the book and focus on them, not because those other aspects aren't interesting, and we may talk about them, but because I think there are some other really interesting components of the book that people aren't focusing on, which I would like to. To set this conversation up, I want you to describe why Bob Mueller called you. You were somebody who had, when he set up this investigation, you were somebody who had a pretty extensive relationship with him. And there were a lot of questions that came up early in the investigation about why there were so many Democrats working for Bob Mueller. You were not called by him because you were a Democrat. Why did Bob Mueller call you, and how did you come to get involved with the special counsel investigation?
So I had worked for Bob Mueller in two other capacities. I'd been the general counsel and before that, the special counsel for Bob Mueller. So I think I was a known quantity. And we had dealt with each other also when I was head of the fraud section. He had become the monitor in connection with the Volkswagen case, and we were conducting the criminal case with the Detroit U.S. Attorney's Office and the Environmental Division. So there was some overlap there. And, you know, some of this is surmise because, you know, you'd really have to ask Bob why he chose me. But I think he's not coming
on the Lawfare podcast.
Given, I'm shocked. I'm shocked, Bob, that he wouldn't be doing that. So, when you think about asking me to head up Team M, the sort of all things Manafort related, you know, I had done so much white collar investigation that to me, that seemed like a pretty natural fit. It was a classic white collar investigation, given what I had done at the fraud section and also on Enron. So I think that was the the reason. I mean, I don't think he could care less whether it was a Republican or a Democrat. I think what he wanted was somebody who was going to be smart and ethical and, as he would say, fast.
So generalize that. There were a lot of interesting questions raised when Mueller was appointed about who the group of people who surrounded him. There was a cluster from Wilmer, his law firm. There was a cluster from, you know, back in his, you know, sometimes way back in his career. And you have a very interesting discussion in the book about trying to staff the Mueller investigation and his feeling like some people you brought in didn't have what he called pizzazz. You know, obviously, without having him here, the kind of what was he looking for question is a little bit speculative, but you're better positioned to speculate about it than anybody else. What was the thing that bound together the Mueller staff, if not Democratic contributions?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things, just an aside on that, is you can understand why people who are attacking the investigation would focus on the lawyers on the case. But, you know, not that I went around and asked all the agents and analysts, but, you know, there were scores of people on the investigation. And while I think it's true just from what then got reported that the lawyers were predominantly Democrats, I don't think that would be true of agents and analysts. You're aware of sort of the general makeup of the intelligence community. So, but I think my sense is that Bob is very comfortable with, you know, people he's worked with before and could trust in terms of their judgment and speed and just their expertise. So I think that was a criteria. And, you know, he always had a penchant for people from the Brooklyn U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, my predecessor at in the general counsel's position, Valerie Caproni, was from Brooklyn. And I tell this story about when I first met Bob to interview, he looked at my resume and sort of slapped his head and said, "Oh my God, are you another one of these unsupervisable AUSAs from Brooklyn?" Which was sort of from his, you know, he was somewhat tongue in cheek, but I think he liked the people who were not going to be hand wringers. You know, one of his famous lines that he uses all the time was, you know, don't play with your food. Like, he likes people to be thoughtful and to think through things, but not to make, you know, the perfect the enemy of the good, you know, in appropriate circumstances. So that's, I think, a lot of what he looked for. And again, just because we've gotten so much scrutiny over this, every single person who was hired, he hired. I mean, you know, we could make recommendations, but ultimately he would give the thumbs up or thumbs down on every single person.
That's a pretty extraordinary fact, because it was a relatively large office as these things go. You know, it was a lot of people hired very quickly.
Yeah. Although, you know, we were hiring through June and July. So, you know, there was a fair amount of time, but I mean, obviously there was a lot going on. We were trying to invest. This is definitely, you know, you're flying in the plane while it's getting built. I mean, you know, our support staff was remarkable, but, you know, so we were hiring and investigating and figuring out where we're going to sit and with computers, and all of that was happening at once. But, you know, there's a very famous story. I'm sure you've heard it, about Bob right after 9/11, and somebody was briefing him on what was going on with the investigation. And he kept on asking questions, as he's wont to do, and question after question. And finally he was like, "Okay, what's the color of the car?" And, you know, the agent was like, "I'm going to have to get back to you." And the point that he was drilling down on was not that he cared about the color of the car. It's that, you know, facts matter, being meticulous matters, you know, knowing all of the details. And, you know, that's just part of his makeup. So when you say it's extraordinary, you know, it might be, but not, I think, for the people who know Bob Mueller, in terms of, you know, what he expects of us and of himself.
So let's talk about that, because one of the things that happened, and we're sort of skipping ahead to the end of the investigation now, was that the public saw Bob Mueller in that congressional testimony and he did not come off the way people expected this very commanding presence of Bob Mueller to be. He seemed a little bit unsure of himself sometimes. And of course, there were a lot of rumors that circulated both before and as a result of that, that he had lost a few steps. So who was the Bob Mueller who ran the investigation, and why did he come off that way to the public and in his congressional testimony?
So I have two stories on that. One is Bob was just as annoying as the special counsel as he was as the FBI director, in that those same kinds of incessant questions to make sure that you knew what you were talking about and knew the details was something that he did in both contexts. And when I say annoying, obviously I'm meaning that somewhat facetiously, it's like that's his job. And it was really useful to know that you had to expect that. And then I have to say, in the hearing, as you probably know, that is not one of the favorite things that for, I think, anyone. And, you know, that's not Bob's, either his strength or something he's really looking forward to, is, you know, testifying in front of Congress. But I also thought it was such an unusual and in some ways unfair circumstance, because normally when you're called to testify, you're not memorizing a 440-page report. And it's totally appropriate to say, I'll get back to you. And for instance, when I heard Bob say, well, if that's in the report, that's what we said, and those are the wording, because he cared about the wording and he cared about what was written and he hadn't memorized it, but it also wasn't a setting where you could say, let me get back to you. So the whole thing struck me as, I mean, I understand the reason Congress, you know, wants the theater of it, but it was I didn't think it was the fair setting for reporting on the report.
The setting was certainly unfair, but there are people who are good at that, and there are people who are not good at that, right? And it's fair to say, do you agree that Mueller's great strength has never been in the public communication side, has never been in the sort of public aspects of the role? And he's quite a contrast in that regard with Jim Comey, his successor. His great strength has been in his private management and in the relationships with and the direction of the people who worked for him.
The one thing I would add to that, Ben, is in smaller settings that are still public, he is remarkable. I remember the first time I heard him when I was FBI general counsel, there had been a bad mistake that the FBI had made. Bob Mueller, you know, is wonderful on those things, because he's like, you deal with it head on, you don't spin, you correct it, you figure out how to audit it. But he met with a bunch of NGOs and Muslim leaders in light of some material that FBI contractors had put out that really should never have seen the light of day because they were just inappropriate. And he was spectacular and, you know, took his jacket off and sat there and answered all of their questions. And I was so proud of the FBI and him. And he's so down to earth and such a straight shooter, and was so clearly communicating that he really deeply cared about the Bureau and the people who were meeting there. You know, he's wonderful in that setting. And some of that may just come from, I think he may have a sort of natural shyness about him. And he's right. Better in those smaller settings.
Yeah, that's an important corrective on my point. Let's talk about Paul Manafort. You were the Manafort guy, and at the beginning of the investigation, you were the only Manafort guy. Like, you were the Paul Manafort investigation.
On the lawyer side, just to be sure. Clear, I was on the only lawyer for a little while, but I had spectacular assistance from FBI agents and analysts.
Fair enough. Paul Manafort became the core of what we came to call, because of the president, the collusion question. Not that there weren't other threads to that, but the most dramatic fact pattern of the Trump campaign not merely receiving assistance from the Russians, but giving them something, is Paul Manafort giving poll data to Konstantin Kilimnik, whom you guys described as having ties with Russian intelligence, and the Senate Intelligence Committee describes as a Russian intelligence officer. Recently, Rick Gates, as you know, has been out there saying, come on, this was top line poll data. A lot of it was public. You know, this is a lot of garbage. I have always regarded this as one of the great unanswered questions. What was this story ultimately about, the Kilimnik relationship? And, you know, I'm interested for your reflections on it. At the end of the day, we have a fact pattern that is cosmically suspicious and doesn't have a punctuation mark or a conclusion at the end of it. And so, without asking you to go beyond what's in the book and what's in the Mueller report, how should we feel about the relationship between the campaign, its chairman, and the Russian, maybe intelligence officer, maybe person with ties to Russian intelligence, to whom he is feeding proprietary campaign data?
Let me start with, for those not in the know or in the weeds the way you and I are, you know, one of the most critical things that we focused on was an August 2nd, 2016 meeting where Konstantin Kilimnik flies all the way from Moscow to meet with Paul Manafort at the Grand Havana Club at 666 Fifth Avenue, a building owned coincidentally by the Kushner family. And they have a conversation, which Kilimnik had said would take a couple hours. And it's important. He has this great email where he describes it as an important caviar story to tell because it's a message he's bringing from someone who had given Paul Manafort the largest jar of black caviar, which we learn is a reference to President Yanukovych, former president of Ukraine, who had fled to Russia. And, you know, the issue is, you know, what is happening at that meeting? What is the conversation? Why would somebody fly all the way from Moscow to have an in-person conversation when they're communicating with each other over email and other forms, you know, prior and after that? There's a lot we do not know. So this is one of those things where for people who want an end of the story, there is no. And one thing that is important to know is there is no evidence that I'm aware of that whatever Paul Manafort was up to with Konstantin Kilimnik, there's no evidence that Manafort communicated that to people above him at the Trump campaign. So we don't know whatever he's up to, whether it was, you know, a rogue operation, whether it's done by Paul Manafort for personal business reasons, whether it's done for reasons to get Trump elected, or as we say in the report, it could be a combination because those two things are not antithetical to each other. And, you know, this is just, you know, my personal opinion is, you know, I think that Paul Manafort can easily have both of those ideas in his head at the same time, especially since they are not mutually exclusive, which is, hey, this may help me with debts that are owed to me from oligarchs and generating new business. But if it also turns out that they're going to use polling data and my discussions about battleground states, of which he identified Wisconsin as a battleground state in August of 2016, which, you know, as you may remember, is not something that I think was generally known. But I could see that all being part and parcel without having to, you know, Paul Manafort's a pro at this. He doesn't need to be thinking, oh no, I'm not going to be in any way thinking what Russia might do with this information. You know, a smart guy would understand that if you're sending polling data to Konstantin Kilimnik to share with, among other people, Oleg Deripaska, who is a prominent Russian oligarch close to Putin, that that could be used. We don't know the full story. Yeah, we did, and I do recount in the book, I do recount how we pieced together what the ask was from Konstantin Kilimnik at that meeting, which was Konstantin Kilimnik wanted the Trump administration to give a, at that point, the Trump campaign, but when it became the administration, to give a wink to Russia being able to take over the eastern part of Ukraine, which is a pretty big ask. What we don't know is what was in it for Paul Manafort or the campaign in order to get them to agree to something like that.
Daniel, the floor is yours for a question.
So I'm curious, had you obtained President Trump's tax returns during the investigation, what new questions beyond the ones you guys were already asking would have the returns raised?
And to be clear, Daniel, you're referring here to the returns as reported recently in that mammoth New York Times story?
That is correct.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So, Andrew, if you had had access to that material, does that change? And you have an extensive discussion in the book about not making a big financial inquiry. Would this $400 million debt have changed that calculation?
Great question. So first you have to posit, if we had the information, the questions, if we had the information that the New York Times reported and it was credible, and so let's say that that is what the tax returns would show. I think there are a number of things that it would have, number of questions that it would have raised. First, from just a counterintelligence perspective, and I know this is an area that, Ben, you've focused a lot on, sort of the criminal versus counterintelligence aspects of our investigation. You know, there's obviously counterintelligence interest in knowing the issue of to whom does the president owe hundreds of millions of dollars. But focusing it narrowly also on the question of the Rod Rosenstein appointment order, we were tasked with looking at links between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. So one of the questions you would have is any of that debt owned in any way, or was it owned in any way at some point by either the Russian government or cutouts of the Russian government, so that you would be able to answer that part of the appointment order. And then finally, to be super in the weeds, one of the things that the New York Times reported was something that struck my attention, which was with respect to the 2013 Miss Universe pageant in Moscow. That was something that was sponsored by a Russian oligarch named Agalarov. But it appears, according to the Times, that that was an unusually profitable Miss Universe pageant. And although the Agalarovs put the money up, they apparently didn't make any money. But Mr. Trump did make a couple million dollars. And of course, the Agalarovs, just to connect finish the connective tissue, were the people who were behind setting up the Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016. So that's something where I think we would have had a number of follow-up questions on that topic.
And let's use this as an opportunity to talk about the decision not to pursue a major finance investigation. So as I read the original referral to you guys, it could be said to be related, but it's not obviously within the mandate that you guys got from Rod Rosenstein. To what extent was it simply, was the problem really that you guys had a mandate that was too narrow for the task that we believe in retrospect, and a lot of people believed at the time, the investigation should cover? And to what extent was the problem that you construed the mandate and that Mueller construed the mandate too narrowly?
Excellent question. I do think that the mandate would have allowed a financial investigation as it related to links between the president and the Russian government. In other words, you would have to tie the financial aspect to that particular issue. In other words, we were not like a U.S. Attorney's Office, which could just do an open-ended investigation. So while we had certain protections that a U.S. Attorney's Office didn't have, we also had a much narrower mandate, and we had narrower tools. But the other is that, you know, a financial motive is something that you look at in trying to figure out why people are doing what they're doing. And finances can be looked at whether it's on the criminal side or the CI side. That's one of the reasons, this is answering a slightly different question. I don't really think of this as, was there a criminal case? Was there a CI case? Because under either label, you could look at finances. In other words, there's a way to justify it, regardless of whether you slap either label on it. That's a little simplistic because there are different scopes that might relate to which way you're looking at it, but there would be a justifiable way of looking at it. One of the things I talk about in the book is that one of the unusual aspects of investigating the president of the United States is that, among other things, he has the power to pull the plug on your investigation. You know, when I prosecuted organized crime figures in New York or Enron figures,
yeah, they don't get to fire cases, you.
But they don't have the ability to just say, yeah, well, now you're done. Exactly. They don't get to dangle pardons and they don't get to fire us. And so one of the decisions that Director Mueller had to make early on in connection with when the White House found out we were subpoenaing information from Deutsche Bank, which we were doing in connection with the Manafort case, where we did do a follow the money classic case, was, you know, are you looking at the president's finances? The president very publicly said that had been a red line. And I actually agree, just, you know, because a lot of people focus on what I disagree with Bob Mueller on, but I think that's a really hard call. And I think at that point, making a decision, which is there's no reason to heighten the risk of being fired. And, you know, as we now know, in June of 2017, just as we were getting off the ground, there actually was a lot of discussion about having us fired. And it was decided to put that on hold while we did things like, just to take TMAR as an example, they put together two incredibly interesting, important cases regarding how Russia attacked the 2016 election.
Right. All right. Tony Cava, you have the next question.
Hello, Mr. Weissman. I heard you on the Bulwark pod yesterday, and it was great. So I'm assuming a Biden presidency, what changes will a new admin and AG need to effect to prevent the kind of interference in independent investigations we've seen on the part of the current AG? And aside from a return to respect for norms, are there changes in the law a new admin and Congress can or should bring to bear? One thing I think of this morning is that perhaps no one in any branch of government should be able to ask someone to sign an NDA. That would be one thing I would suggest. Thank you.
I do not have a silver bullet on this in terms of how to figure out what to do, but I do think that one of the things that I'm trying to get people to think about is, do the special counsel rules work? You know, if you put it historically in terms of what happened in Watergate and creating the independent counsel, and then Ken Starr and creating the special counsel rules, this is a really good inflection point to think about, do these rules function as they should function? Obviously, one answer is go back to the independent counsel rules. And, you know, I'm with my fellow academics on this, Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith, which is, you know, maybe that is eventually something one would need to do, but there are a lot of downsides with an independent counsel. And so I've tried to think of things that could deal with some of the issues that we dealt with. One is the triggering event for when a special counsel is appointed. One would be to have the DNI have a role, particularly when there's an intelligence aspect to the investigation. I don't think the special counsel rules that currently exist were contemplating that as much as we take that for granted now as a feature. The other is to have Congress have a greater ability. There are obvious limitations in terms of how that could work. And then I do think that for the sake of time, I do think that the special counsel rules have to have a more public-facing educational function to them so that a lot of things that I think would be beneficial could occur, such as it would have been useful to have Rod Rosenstein or the special counsel discuss the DOJ internal guidance so that there wasn't a general perception that, you know, a president could be indicted, because that's not possible under DOJ rules that we were governed by. And I think there also needs to be an educational function in terms of how a report is then disseminated. And I hark back to Archibald Cox and, you know, his pretty famous press conference where he articulated for the public why it was that he was going to seek Supreme Court review for acquiring the Nixon tapes. So there are a variety of things that could be done to ameliorate the problems that we faced.
All right, David Batts, the floor is yours.
Greetings. Thanks so much for presenting. What are your thoughts about, in light of not only the challenges associated with the Mueller report and the report out, but I'll call it the attacks of the administration, both on justice and the FBI, what is the path to redemption for both justice and the FBI, and how long might this be expected to take?
Whenever we get to a post-Trump era, I do think that there will be, maybe it's as optimistic, but I do think that there will be people on the so-called right and left that are very interested in reestablishing trust and norms and stronger guardrails for things such as the independence of the Department of Justice. You know, that independence is, it's easy to forget just how central that independence needs to be to avoid us turning into what Ukraine used to be. In other words, where the Department of Justice is used as just a tool to go after political enemies. And I think that the next attorney general is going to need to be particularly transparent about what she or he is doing and what the department is doing to instill that trust in the department, because there's so many thousands of people in the department and in the intelligence community that are career people who are really trying to just do the right thing, who don't think about politics. And I think it's going to take significant work to have people understand that these are people who we should be incredibly proud of and thankful for.
Alden Daniel.
Hi, thanks for taking the time to do this. It's been really, really interesting. I guess I'm just curious about what you and other people on the investigation made of the public discourse around the report, both prior to its release and following. Thank you.
It's a great question.
Yeah, I open the book and end the book with a discussion of Bill Barr's purported 4-page summary. That was an unusual and heart-wrenching moment, because in spite of some concern about his so-called audition memo, there was a sense that I think a lot of people had that he was an institutionalist who would be somebody who you might disagree with from a policy perspective, which is fine. That's where, you know, elections have consequences. That happens all the time. I've had disagreements with Democratic and Republican attorney generals. That's what happens. But that was a moment where we knew internally that he had, and I'm going to put this charitably, completely mischaracterized the report. And so, you know, the scales fell from our eyes, but that we knew that the public did not yet know What I think a lot of people currently see over and over again, which is this enormous politicization of the department and it being too cozy with the what the White House wants, not as a policy matter, but in terms of individual criminal cases, which that is a line that, you know, is just verboten, you know, in my 20 years of being at the department. So that was soul crushing in terms of its reception. The larger reception, you know, I could see how that had the effect. I mean, it was very skillful of pulling the teeth on the more damning parts of the report. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons, to go back to the last question, I think it's really important for the special counsel rules to really focus on who the audience is for a special counsel report. And I think most people think that we were going to write something that was more like the 9/11 Commission report with findings, and it was going to be public, and there were going to be recommendations and conclusions. But instead, you know, the special counsel rules are that this is going to be an internal report that just goes to the Attorney General. So we had this mishmash. It was sort of, to me, we were given one direction under the rules, but everyone sort of knew it was really going to need to accomplish a separate role. And so I think that needs to be clarified so that the next special counsel is not in that position.
Yeah, so let's talk about a few things that you've been asked about a lot, but we have gotten pretty near the end of this discussion without talking about, but I do think we should touch on. So there was a group of us that you mentioned Bill Barr's response and summary, which conditioned a huge amount of public discussion, particularly on the right, up to and including the vice president's comments at the debate yesterday, that this was, the finding was no collusion, no obstruction, it was all a hoax, right? The president says that almost daily. On the other hand, there were people who said, you found 11 instances of obstruction, and you just wouldn't put your name on it, or Bob Mueller wouldn't say it, but found 11 instances of obstruction and extensive, you know, contacts that was collusion in every sense except the legal sense of meeting this provable with admissible evidence definition of conspiracy within the meaning of Title 18. How would you characterize the findings if you had to write the four-page summary, what you guys found about obstruction and what you guys found about so-called collusion? What would be your, as Bill Barr put it, summary of major findings?
So the easy answer to that, Ben, is that each of the two volumes of the report had a summary. We had actually written summaries, and I had assumed, I'm just going to speak for myself, that those were going to be, if the Attorney General was going to decide to give a summary, as opposed to just wait and produce the entire report, you know, after the redaction process, that he would just produce the summaries. Because why would you take the political risk of under or overstating what we had done? There was a reason that the special counsel was reported, which was because of the inherent conflict of the Department of Justice and a political appointee investigating the president. So is out of that deference of 22 months of work, you would take the exact words and wouldn't engage in the process of trying to put your own, even a good faith process of trying to characterize something. So that's sort of the easy answer, which was, it was written for him. Maybe I'll stop there. But there are just many, you know, if I was going to give another example, I would say, let's say you were trying to describe in volume one and what Russia was up to. I wouldn't have said, as Bill Barr did, that Russia was trying to sow discord. So misleading, because that's not what we found. We had two indictments that were chapter and verse that Russia was not sowing discord in the sense they didn't care who would win. They just wanted to play on divisions. They were pro-Trump in the primary and in the general election. And they were actively trying to also suppress the vote of Black and brown people and Bernie Sanders supporters. And that is in black and white over and over again. And that didn't appear anywhere in the so-called summary letter.
Yeah. So my summary, which we wrote on Lawfare almost immediately, I think the day the report came out, reads something like this. And I have not looked back at it. This is my recollection of how we summarized it, but I'm interested for your sense of whether it dovetails with whether you feel represented by it, that the report concludes with respect to collusion, that there were extensive contacts, extensive efforts on the part of the Russians to probe and make contact with and engage many different figures of the Trump campaign and transition, that none of these reached a level of prosecutable conspiracy, but it is fair for people to draw whatever conclusions short of the criminal law they may want to draw. And that on the question of obstruction, the office put together a very large body of evidence across a range of activity that measures against the elements of the core obstruction offenses and deferred not to the Attorney General, but to future prosecutors and to Congress as to how to weigh those against A, the criminal statutes in question, but B, the other remedies available to Congress, i.e. impeachment. Does that feel to you like what you guys found?
Pretty close. I mean, again, it's an impromptu summary is going to leave something out. But I think on the first part, I would make sure, and this may be implicit in what you said, that you not only had efforts by Russia to reach out and to assist the Trump campaign, but you had efforts by the Trump campaign to reach out to Russia. So you had a receptivity. So, you know, the Trump Tower meeting is sort of a classic example of that, where it didn't happen because essentially Russia didn't have the goods. But it's not like you had people in the Trump campaign saying, no, 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 we would never take foreign assistance in an American election, which, by the way, is illegal. So you had, in fact, people, you know, sitting at a meeting going, yeah, what do you got? And it didn't go anywhere because they didn't actually have the dirt that they claim to have. And on obstruction, one thing that's worth saying is that Bob Mueller's thinking on that, where he was not going to put a label on it, comes from such a noble place, because it comes from that tradition of not casting aspersions on somebody who has not been indicted and doesn't have an ability, at least immediately, to go to court to clear his or her name. And so both that and the idea that if you present all the facts, to the extent Congress wants to weigh it, they should do their job. They don't need to have Bob Mueller's imprimatur. And that is a very, very defensible position and comes from a really noble place. I think that because the special counsel rules were written for us to be providing a private report to the Attorney General, my issue is there was that issue of how what would happen publicly was really an issue for the Attorney General. Under the special counsel rules as written, we had the ability and I think the duty to tell the Attorney General or the acting Attorney General what our recommendation was with respect to the facts. And if you put the legal issue aside, which is whether the president is covered by the obstruction statute, I think most career federal prosecutors worth their salt would say that the proof was sufficient to find obstruction.
More than sufficient. I have two more questions and then we'll wrap up. The first is, you describe this as coming from a noble place. You are also very critical of Jim Comey in the early chapters of the book for his own behavior that was different from this. That is, for reaching conclusions about unindicted people, describing unindicted conduct. And yet you have written a book that kind of does that. I mean, you are constrained by a record in some sense, but you're also talking about a bunch of unindicted people. So square the circle. Is this such an exceptional case that, you know, it's kind of okay to do that? Or is this a situation in which there's some other reason why the prosecutor shouldn't just shut up?
So I think that's apples and oranges. I mean, it's a really good question. But if you look at what Jim Comey did in declining to give a public recommendation to the department, which is bizarre, and to give a public recommendation that there no charge should be brought, and then to give his personal opinion about, you know, how this, you know, that's denigrating the person who will not be charged, is a really different situation than one where the Attorney General, with the consent of the White House, has not only published a 430-page report, but has also issued numerous 302s publicly. And their department, I went through 4 months of a pre-publication review so that the department would screen it for any of those kinds of issues, grand jury issues, ongoing investigation issues. And so the people that I'm talking about are either ones that have actually been charged, these are not uncharged people, or have been with the department's, not just acquiescence, but the department's, you know, doing, been publicly described. So, you know, I do think it's a really fair question, but I think there are significant factual differences.
Finally, at the highest level of altitude, what are the major accomplishments of the Mueller investigation, and what were its principal deficiencies?
The highest level, which I said to Jeannie Rhee over and over again, she was the lawyer who led Team R part of the case, was the two indictments that her team put together that was remarkable work and should enjoy bipartisan support. She and her team put together cases that showed how a foreign adversary was able to attack our democracy, and that is still going on. And, you know, one of the reasons I was not happy to see that one of the cases that she brought being dismissed was that there wasn't the ability for this to play out in court. Yes, it's in our report. Yes, it's in two indictments, but there wasn't actually a court proceeding because this department pulled the plug on that shortly before it was supposed to go to trial. I analogize that to the attack on Pearl Harbor. Obviously, there's no loss of life and it's not comparable in that sense, but it is comparable. And in fact, I think more pernicious in terms of its fundamental reach into something that's core to our democracy. And I think that's the lasting legacy. One of the things, to take the second part of your question, Ben, that I'm concerned about is, by not subpoenaing the president in this situation, and again, obviously reasonable minds can differ. I mean, if Robert Mueller made the decision, it's by definition a reasonable mind can differ on this. If it doesn't mean that the criticism is reasonable. But I'm very concerned about the precedent that's set for the next, you know, God forbid, investigation of the presidency, where someone can say, even in a case as important as an investigation as important as this one, you know, and the centrality of the president's intent people are going to be able to look back and say, well, it didn't happen here. And that is concerning to me.
The book is Where Law Ends. The author is Andrew Weissman. Andrew, it's good to see you again, have you back among the living, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. And today, I think we should add that it is produced in extensive cooperation with Zachary Frank and Ian Enright of the firm Goat Rodeo, because this was a little bit more of a goat rodeo than we were expecting. You can do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share us on Twitter, upvote us on Reddit, pin us on Pinterest, and make TikTok videos about it if you have been foolish enough to download TikTok. You can get Lawfare merch at the Lawfare store. And if you want to become a patron of Lawfare and thus have access to these wonderful crowdcasts where you get to ask live questions on the podcast, go to our brand new Patreon site and become a member of Lawfare Live. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.